Samuel Burkholz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's nice to be here with you. Thank you so much.
This book, A Guided Tour of Hell, grew out of a near-death experience that you had. It wasn't the first, but it was also very different from the first one. I wonder if you could talk about both experiences.
Sure. Near-death experiences are weird. I don't know why they call them near-death, because you're actually dead. But then you come back and you're alive. So I guess since you haven't died, they're called near-death. But you did die. And I had an experience when I was about 25 years old. I had been in India, and somehow I'd gotten bitten by probably not a mosquito, but some vermin. And I developed a case of typhus fever, which is a rough disease. And it has an incubation period of about 2 weeks. So when I returned to America, I ended up in a hospital, and I was being treated for what they thought was malaria. And one day, my temperature went up to the point where you're supposed to be gone, and I was packed on ice, and I had the experience of leaving my body, and you know, it's the classic experience. There you are, you leave your body, some consciousness is floating at the top of the room, you see your dead body, you hear the doctors and nurses speaking, and there's a sense of relief because that which you usually hold so precious, your body, is in so much pain, it is, you know, a complete relief to leave it. And I experienced, you know, after that, you know, there's this sense of being there, and then my consciousness leaving through a tunnel of light. People have heard these experiences. They're very common. In my particular case, while I was in that state, I was apparently injected with something or whatever. They found out that I had typhus and not malaria and started treating me differently. And I came back into my body with a huge sonic boom-like explosion that was painful beyond belief. And, you know, I was alive and happily so. So that's the typical near-death experience. And I had that when I was in my 20s. And it did change my view of the world. I understood how impermanent my life was, you know, can disappear in a moment. Mm-hmm. And maybe it had some effect upon me. And I describe that first death in my book. But there was no idea of hell. There was maybe some heavenly idea of like following the light. And I remember looking at Doré's illustrations to Dante, and there is one that was, you know, almost exactly an artistic view of that experience that I could easily relate to as being, oh yes, that happened to me.
You say the word consciousness. What was your sense or understanding of what consciousness is after that experience?
I don't really know because, you know, I was a 20-something year old. I had a lot of interest in philosophies of various kinds. I studied Western philosophies. I studied Eastern philosophies. In fact, the vermin that transmitted the typhus to me was transmitted in Bodh Gaya, where the historical Buddha attained enlightenment, and probably within a few yards of where he attained enlightenment, whatever that means. So there was some connection because I had gone to India on this combined book-buying trip. I was a bookseller and pilgrimage to Buddhist places and wanting to see the historical places of the Buddha, wanting to see the historical places in India that I was interested in.
And you certainly had a kind of short circuit to enlightenment there.
I don't know if it was a short circuit to enlightenment. I think it's what you'd call a short circuit to samsara, the endless cycle of life and rebirth.
Say more about that.
In Buddhist thought, the ordinary world, as we know it, which includes our mind, is described as samsara, this constant circling through various realms. And these realms are psychological realms and physical realms. And they include all kinds of experiences, like the human realm being one of those experiences, and various heavenly realms and various other realms like animal realm and hungry ghost realm and hell realm. And from the Buddhist teaching, these various realms are viewed as the sort of psychodrama of our continuing life and death experiences, transmigration through these various realms. In Buddhism, unlike in Hinduism, there's an idea of rebirth rather than reincarnation, which is a constant sense of dying and being reborn, dying and being reborn. In fact, it's even said that, you know, when we go to bed, that's a kind of death, mm-hmm. rebirth when we awake. And from one thought to the next is like a death and a birth.
So in a way, what you're saying is that this endless cycle exists on many levels, from the micro level that we may experience all the time, every day, to the death of our physical body.
Exactly. And there's no big differentiation between the death of a thought and the death of a body. Body is just another part of our so-called reality, but the one that we, you know, hold on to so preciously, because it's what attaches us to this earth. But earth is only one of the earthly realm. The human realm is only one of the realms from the Buddhist point of view.
So attachment, you know, many of us and many of our listeners, I'm sure, know that the idea of attachment and suffering are very closely aligned and very much part of this book, A Guided Tour of Hell, as well. So I wonder if you could give us a sense of what is the connection between attachment and suffering?
Well, it depends on what you mean by attachment. Attachment means different things for different people, actually. Mm-hmm. So we have attachment to people, mother, father, lover, son, daughter, and we have, that can be like a positive attachment. And then we have negative attachments. You know, we're sitting here sort of at the bottom of Trump Tower, and so some people have very negative attachment to this tower and what it represents. And some people are out here on the street and have very positive attachment to it. So attachment can be the same phenomena, can have different attachment to people. Attachment means that there's some vested idea that goes with what we want to hold on to. And attachment's not necessarily a bad thing. I know that the people like to think, oh, it's good not to be attached. Well, there's no problem with being attached, actually, is what I've found. As long as you can let go. Attachment has a use. So you can be attached to a child, for example, you know, so you can care for a child. Attached to a lover, so you can care for a lover. But with the attachment comes its exact opposite, non-attachment. So attachment and non-attachment can exist simultaneously. Attachment's only a problem if one gets stuck in it. But attachment is born and attachment dies, like everything else. Mm-hmm. It has an impermanent quality to it. So you can make attachment positive, you can make attachment negative, but regardless, you have to let attachment go.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Samuel Burkholz about his new book, A Guided Tour of Hell, a graphic memoir, and we'll get to the graphic part as well. But now let's talk about the book, because we've talked about attachment and letting go. I've mentioned the word suffering. Hell is a place of unbelievable suffering, certainly as you describe it in this book. Tell us about your second experience of a near-death experience and how different it was.
Well, my so-called second experience, I was in a hospital. I'd had sextuple bypass surgery, and I was recovering from it. And I was walking around the hallways with my nurses, joking about getting out of there, and I was going to get out the next day. And at one point, I suddenly sort of fall over. And apparently, I had been hit by what was described as possibly a blood infection. We don't know what it was. And again, not unlike my first near-death experience, there was a high fever or so on. I was put on ice. My vital signs went down to close to nothing. And my subjective experience, and I can only call it subjective because I have no idea what's objective, but my subjective experience was of death. And it was not a surprise, particularly. I'd seen other people die, and I knew what it looked like, but it was so quick. I don't know. It's a funny thing to talk about. And there is nothing, you can't prepare yourself for it. It's just what happens in that moment. Mm-hmm. And the things that I know, I knew I was dying, and then I knew I was dead. But the idea of myself dissipated. And then there was just the consciousness of what was about, rather than my identification with the consciousness. And suddenly, it was as if I was pulled down by seemingly my legs, but again, my subjective experience, into another realm. And there was like a huge rush of being pulled into these depths. And I arrived in this realm, or I say I, but there's, I have to use language of this world to describe language, to describe another world that exists not with the same set of circumstances as this world. So the circumstances of space and time, totally different. Mm-hmm. They really don't exist in terms of what we think of in dimensions. Consciousness doesn't really exist of what we think of in these dimensions, because there's no I to go back to, no body to go back to. And I was, to be frank, whatever my consciousness was or whatever the consciousness was embarrassed slightly, because I knew where I was. And it was in the depths of hell.
And you thought, well, gee, I thought I was a good person all this time.
No, it doesn't quite work like that, but I thought, or whatever the thinking or the consciousness was, this is impossible. First of all, this does not exist. You know, I always thought of hell as being a fairy. Hells, even in the Buddha sense, of being like fairy tales for peasants. To be absolutely frank, even though I'm a very faithful practitioner of Buddhism and so on, I'm one of the biggest skeptics that ever lived. And all those sections about the realms and hell and so on, you know, I read a lot of books, and a lot of Buddhist books have these sections, and I would always take those sections, pull all those pages together, and flip them. And that's for peasants. So I had an aversion to these sort of tales. But then I found myself in the middle of this realm, and I was, this is how I describe it, I was met by the Buddha of hell and assured that I wasn't a denizen of hell, but that I was here to be shown the suffering of beings.
I also had a hard time wrapping my mind around this. I mean, to me, it felt like this is metaphor. These are lessons for us. So I'm not sure I can even go where you went, because it's not something I've experienced. But whichever it is, well, you know, however people experience your book, whether they experience it as a metaphor or they experience it as some real place, describe the suffering and the cause of the suffering, because you do say that there are some common elements to all the different kinds of suffering that you saw the denizens of hell go through.
In hell, so to speak, because I'm describing this as hell. Mm-hmm. When I came back, I don't know if it was my wife that was there or my son. I think it might have been my son. I immediately related to him that while I was away, by the way, I was in hell. And he looked at me sort of incredulously, and he said, Dad, good thing. I read that most experiences in hell last for eons. Yours was only a few minutes. However, in the sense of subjective time, it was more like a few aeons. But in terms of a hospital time, it was 5 minutes at most. But I was shown a complete universe, so to speak, and a vast variety of details within that universe. Now, when I landed in hell, I didn't quite understand that I had ended up in the palm of the Buddha of hell's hand. And I'm using metaphor here. I can't say what actually happened because it's beyond saying. But because I have to say, it was, you know, this experience of being within this kindness, compassion, and the kindness and compassion manifested as fire, and it manifested as water. So any consciousness that I had was this interplay of this duality of fire and water.
So what were some of the common elements of the suffering of those who you experienced there? And how you know, who did you see?
The most common element is duality. That is the message, so to speak, of the hot and the cold. It's unified in the Buddha's hand, which is in an awakened view of it, there is no separation between duality. So duality is the simple way that the mind works that differentiates some idea of an individual self from everybody and everything else. The bugaboo of hell and the bugaboo of all suffering is separating oneself from anything else, in fact. Mm-hmm. It's creating this self-referential phenomena that we call me. And it's only a problem if we make it a problem. It's just a tendency. We're human beings. We have this tendency to self-reference. However, if we make that self-referencing solid by repeating it endlessly, by repeating all kinds of lies, including the lie that I am separate, we believe this separateness. So at the core of the hell experience, at the core of suffering, is separating this idea of me from whatever happens in life, including pain, including pleasure, including what we might hold on to. Some people view ego as a problem. Ego is only a problem if you believe it. It's usable. There's so many usable things. Duality is only a problem if you believe it. There is something very practical about that and this.
It's like we have individual bodies, but we know from physics that we're mostly empty space.
Exactly.
And yet those people in hell are stuck in those thoughts. They never end.
Exactly.
And so describe, give us a for instance of somebody that you experienced in hell.
In hell, there are countless numbers of beings. Each being in hell, views their situation as being the absolute worst situation and pays no attention to the fact that there are all these multiple numbers of suffering beings that in fact may be suffering much more than them. All they care about is their own suffering, their own pain, and so on. And, you know, like, oh, woe is them that they got here. And some of them, of course, there's no woe. They, you know, they may have been powerful figures in life. And, you know, it's just like they may actually gloat at the fact that they're there in hell suffering and so on. But it's all this reference to some solidity. You know, but they're a bunch of zombies. They're not alive. They're dead. There is no life in hell. But there's no death in hell either. The suffering doesn't die.
And so the root of the suffering is duality?
The habit of duality. Duality, from this point of view, doesn't really exist. Duality is something that people, quote-unquote, experience. And it's how they experience it, whether they subscribe or whether they don't subscribe, has so much to do with it. It's about habit. And the habit can take on different forms. Like in life, we have various habits like drugs, emotional habits, all kinds of habits. So duality and habits are totally connected. So we have duality habit, which is always separating ourselves out from phenomena. And then we have this other strange phenomenon, reality habit, always trying to materialize everything as being quote-unquote real, and that which isn't completely material and provable doesn't actually exist. So we have these strange habits that fight with each other. The beings in hell, because they're stripped of their bodies, they're dead, create illusory hell bodies that sort of approximate what they think of what they should look like. But it never works out because there's nothing, there's no, hell is immaterial. It just feels material because of this attachment to the ideas of so-called reality and the habit of me and everything else.
One of the most striking sections was the section, one of the first ones, about suicide. You talked about how people commit suicide to end suffering and find themselves in exponentially greater suffering.
To me, this is one of the saddest aspects of human life and the saddest aspects of things that I was shown in the hell realm. Because suffering can be so extreme, there's the idea that if we just end it all, that would be better. But ending it all is a kind of wishful thinking, that there is no end at all. In fact, the death of the physical body, yes, ends the physical body. But in Buddhism, for example, it's taught that, yes, the physical body falls away. And in Buddhism, there's no idea of a soul. Some people think there is, but it's not like Hinduism or the Abrahamic religions. But what is constant is consciousness. Consciousness without a habit of duality. So the idea that one can just destroy oneself is a weird wishful thinking. So those that think they're going to be saved by annihilation are in for a surprise. Now, of course, there are kinds of suicide that are conscious suicide that benefit beings. You know, we've heard many stories of soldiers and just ordinary people in war situations and so on that give their lives to help others. And I think you could call that a suicide, but it's not it doesn't have a streak of nihilism in it.
What about someone who is in intractable pain?
pain sucks. Let's just be straight about it. If one consciously suicides, so to speak, and I really don't know, this is my opinion, and is not looking for just the end, is for because of the enormousness of the pain, either their own pain or the pain of their family, friends, lovers, whatever it might be, you know, there can be situations where allowing the physical body to die before its quote-unquote natural death is, I don't see as any problem at all.
So it seems to me that what you're really saying is illusion is the key to hell, that the illusions we have about separateness or the illusions we have that if we just do this, everything's going to be okay or it's going to feel fine, that it's somehow in that sense of, you've said the word wishful thinking over and over again, that that's where hell lies.
Yes. Hell lies in not paying attention. It really is comes from not only not paying attention to others, but not paying attention in a nasty way, even though it may not seem nasty. It's like wiping out whole aspects of humanity through some sort of inner prejudice, for example, or trying to create oneself as superior to other beings, not seeing the common humanity. All beings suffer. That's what we beings have in common. And it depends on how we work with the suffering. If we develop kindness and compassion, or we develop avarice and looking down upon. If we develop avarice and looking down upon, then we end up in the hell of being the one who is looked down upon and the one that is constantly hurt.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Samuel Burkholz. His book is A Guided Tour of Hell, a graphic memoir. So let's talk a little bit about the graphic part of this book. First of all, why did you decide to look for an illustrator and make this as a graphic memoir?
I had no idea how to relate my experience after I came back. And I tried to write, you know, a couple essays, little book, this, you know, and so on and so on. And I really wanted to communicate what I had seen, but I couldn't find a language to do it. One day I decided, okay, I'm going to try this out in public, and I'm going to try it out as far away from home as I could. So I was invited to give a seminar in Healesville, Australia, southern Australia, and I could have it on any topic I wanted. So I chose A Guided Tour of Hell as the topic, and I thought for the most part the people that would come to see it would be people, you know, people of my own age, gray-haired, you know, 60s, you know, and up, and so on. I was surprised to find at the seminar that the average age was actually more like in the 30s. And of course there were gray hairs, but there were teens too. It was a mixed crowd, and that the interest in the subject was not just old people ready to die. And one of the younger people at the seminar suggested that this would be really important for his generation to know something about, and said, why don't you do a book that's more like a movie? And with pictures, get an artist. You say it's hard to articulate what you experienced. Well, picture's worth 1,000 words, right? So I said, okay, I'll see what I can do. But it was very hard finding an artist.
And you found an amazing artist, a young Tibetan artist. What strikes me, not only, I mean, his illustrations are both beautiful and terrifying, but they remind me a lot of the Doré illustrations, you know, it came to me. So was Dante channeling the Buddhist hell? Was Doré channeling? I mean, in other words, is this some kind of common? Is there some kind of common Jungian, you know, experience or knowledge of this, or you know, how did these come about?
I was shocked when I started looking at other representations of hell and how close they were to what I experienced, which made me realize that this is not just about psychological states. This is something common to being human, and that it exists in so many cultures. And then I looked at Dante differently. I did look at Dante again. Of course, I read a little bit of Dante when I was in school and so on. And I went, whoa, this isn't just literature. This is a map of a world that I was in a world not exactly like this. It's described in the language and time of Dante and Italy and so on, but there is a lot that is almost exactly the same. And I looked at traditions from Japan, from India, various places around the world, and I said, wow. And while I was doing my research, my wife Amy had suggested that she and I had met this young artist named Pema Tae, and she had remembered that he had told her that when he was a young boy, not only did he enjoy painting celestial Buddhas and so on, but he liked painting comic book figures. And so I went to meet Pema, thinking, this isn't going to work. I don't want a traditional Tibetan style thing. I'm not Tibetan. I'm not going to present a Tibetan worldview. I met with him. We spent that first time, I thought we'd have a little interview for a half hour. We spent 6 or 7 hours together where I described these worlds to him, and he described details of the same world I was describing because we could see it simultaneously. It was a strange mind meld that I call it a mind meld. I'm, you know, it's from Star Wars, but this was sort of an artistic mind meld. And over the next 3 years, we spent hours and hours together where the world was described, and then he could see it, and then he could paint it. And the paintings are extraordinary. These are illustrations for a book, but the paintings in themselves are glorious arts of work. And a few museums have decided that they're going to show them, like the Asian Art Museum of San Francisco and the Victoria and Albert Museum and the National Palace Museum of Taiwan, because they're masterworks. And yes, they are at the same level as Doré or Botticelli. There's some greatness to this work, because it is these are paintings of a world that does exist, but you know, it's not New York City. Though some of it looks a little like New York City. it's not Asia, but some of it looks like Asia, and so on. There are these parallels between the hell world and this ordinary world that we exist in. There's crossover. And what we were able to do in this book was, through language and through art, speak of the hell realm as not something from the past, not something that's culturally bound, but that exists in a way that we can relate to it. And we can understand what the trap of hell is and how to be liberated from hell. The main liberator, there's a character in the book. Her name is Jana Sophia. And she is always there. But I didn't notice her when I first God tells, because one is so busy with the suffering and seeing the suffering and so on. But above all the suffering is this amazing being, Jhana Sophia. Her name gives her away, because Jhana in the Sanskrit and Sophia in the Greek refer to wisdom. And she is the wisdom being which liberates from hell. How does she liberate from hell? If you can see her, that's the liberation itself. So it's a seeing wisdom. Wisdom is what allows hell to pass as just another realm.
And she's always there.
Continuous. However, beings in hell, beings in the human realm, are too busy to see her, too busy about themselves, always too busy about themselves, so they can't even see the beauty of Sophia Jhana. But when her teardrop catches your teardrop, there's magic that happens. And the magic is that you see each other. It's non-dual, and that non-duality is an aspect of wisdom.
So my final question is: you have had you've really been at the heart of the spread of Buddhism in this country. You founded Shambhala Books in San Francisco. You were a founding member of the Naropa Institute. You know, you've been doing this for decades. I wonder if you could just comment on what you see as the role of Buddhism today in America, you know, how you've seen this whole long trajectory happen.
Buddhism has affected this culture in a pop sort of way. So there are, you know, like keywords like mindfulness is the big word right now, and the idea of being mindful, extremely positive, as far as I'm concerned. The idea of Zen or meditation, extremely positive. What I pray for, and I'm a person of faith, is that it becomes more than just catchwords, that that the full vision of Buddhism enriches society and enriches the ability to let go, for people to let go of their bad habits so that they can develop good habits, so that they can have no habits at all, which is what enlightenment is.
Well, Sam Burkholz, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about Buddhism and about your new book, A Guided Tour of Hell.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.